evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Yes, my client was violently arrested yesterday, but one, that's on 28th of December 2021, by a joint team of security comprising elements from the military, from the police and intelligence.
The lawyer for a critic of the Ugandan president and his son says his recent arrest is illegal and an affront to provisions of the constitution that protect free speech.
They should leave because they are known as being military delinquents, really. If Ugandans believe that they have a legitimate concern with regard to the act of terrorism that was committed a month ago.
The former governor of Kasai province in the DRC is calling for the immediate withdrawal of all Ugandan troops from the country.
When it was the Tanganyika Independence Day, 60 years of Tanganyika independence, Freeman Mbowe was not allowed to receive food from his family. So we asked the prison service to come out and explain to the public why they did so, but until today they didn't do anything.
And Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, calls on the Human Rights Commission to investigate why the prison service will not accept food from the family of its national chairman, Freeman Mbowe. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A lawyer for Kakwenza Rakirabashaija, an author and critic of the Ugandan president and his son, says his recent arrest is illegal and an affront to provisions of the constitution that protect free speech. Attorney Aaron Kiza is critical of the use of state institutions, including the police and judiciary, against critics of the administration. He adds that disputes between his client and President Yoweri Museveni and his son, Lieutenant General Muhoozi Kainerugaba, should be addressed in a civilian court. Kiza's remarks come after the police arrested his client, Kakwenza Rakirabashaija, who has been a sharp critic of the president and his son. He has accused the president of being the cause of the country's suffering and described his son as obese. Civil society groups and opposition parties have condemned the arrest. For the latest development in the case, I reached lawyer Aaron Kiza in the capital, Kampala.
Yes, my client was violently arrested yesterday, but one, that's on 28th of December 2021, by a joint team of security comprising elements from the military, from the police and intelligence. They whisked him off to an unknown location, but police is handling the investigation part of it, especially the crime intelligence division of the police and the criminal investigation department of police. Especially the cyber crimes division, they are handling the file, and they have assured me, one, that he's fine, that he's not hurt, two, that they will produce him on court either tomorrow or Monday, and that in any event, we shall be able to access him tomorrow. Those are guarantees I got from police. The test of the padding is in the eating. I'll wait and see tomorrow what shape he's in, and whether we will be able to get him freedom. He's in illegal detention and no one has been able to see him. Not just lawyers failing to see him, but even his family, even his doctors, and any other person concerned or interested in his welfare.
Well, Aaron, why are you saying he's illegally detained if what he has said is so egregious that the police will find it necessary or the authorities will find it necessary to arrest him? And you said he was violently arrested. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, they broke into his premises without an arrest warrant, broke his door, broke his windows, and then threatened to break his legs, as I heard, as I was on phone with my client, until they confiscated his phone as part of the arrest, and I haven't heard from him since then. So illegal because of the excessive violence that was used, illegal because they had no arrest warrant, which is a legal requirement. Illegal because it has now exceeded 48 hours allowed to detain the person according to our constitution, what you are overhearing in the train. And illegal because if the detention is incommunicado, no one has been able to see or speak to him.
Did the police tell you or the authorities tell you why he was arrested?
Yeah, they are urging me to wait for a charge sheet, but they're also indicating that it has to do with offensive communication, and that is also indicated by the Department of Police handling this case, the cyber crimes. So that's it.
Some people are saying that he was abusing both the president and his son. And many people are saying he was even bordering on defamation and threatening national security.
The thing about if the man is having a spat, a Twitter spat between him and a certain person, the police shouldn't be getting excited about it. It should be a matter for the two people to settle in civil courts and not using or abusing the institutions of the state or taking advantage of the criminal justice system to harass or intimidate him in his writing. So for my thing, the police should get out of the way. If people are quarreling, that is normal. If he is offended by the communication, that is constitutionally protected. Offensive speech is constitutionally protected. It is made be morally reprehensible, but we are not, the state does not exist to enforce morals, but to enforce the law.
Are you saying that the powers that be are using state institutions like the police and the judiciary to intimidate and harass opponents or critics of the administration?
Yes, I'm saying that. And in this specific case, they are trying to harass someone who is a talented writer, a recent PEN Award international winner, someone who has offered works critical, including books, two books published that are critical of the regime and how it handles critics.
What's next for him? Since you said he's being held incommunicado, what's next? What's the next line of action as his lawyer that he will take?
We are moving to court to order a conditional release. That's what, in the case they renege on their promises to produce him in court, then we want court to order them to produce him because he should be produced within court within 48 hours, which elapsed today at 4 p.m.
Aaron Kiza is a lawyer for a Ugandan government critic. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, a former governor of Kasai province is calling for the immediate withdrawal of all Ugandan troops from the country. Herbert Kubasu Babu Katolondi, who is also the author of the recently published book, U.S. Marines in the Congo-Benin War, says Ugandan troops have a bad reputation in the DRC. He says it's unfortunate that President Felix Tshisekedi gave Kampala the green light to deploy troops to the country. He says the gesture undermines the country's territorial integrity, which he argues could also demoralize its national army. The Ugandan People's Defense Force, or UPDF, says its core objective in the DRC is to defeat and dismantle the rebel group Allied Democratic Forces, or ADF. This after the administration in Kinshasa announced a joint military offensive against the militants. Analysts say the joint military offensive appears to have been launched after the ADF claimed responsibility for the recent twin bombings in Uganda. For more on his call for the withdrawal of Ugandan troops from the DRC, I spoke with Herbert Kubasu Babu Katolondi.
They should leave because they are known as being military delinquents. Really, if Ugandans, as I believe that they have a legitimate concern with regard to the act of terrorism that was committed a month ago, they could have spoken with the Congolese and the UN so that the tactic or the strategy or the operations of MONUSCO and various African contingent, particularly the Force Intervention Brigade, FIB, can remodel their tactics to overwhelm the ADF. So it doesn't make sense for a president of a country to call on people who had killed his own citizens, who had destroyed his own country. It doesn't make sense at all.
But according to Ugandan officials, their soldiers were treated as liberators. People were happy that the terrorism and the violence carried out by the rebels against these populations are getting some relief because of its joint military offensive. So why should they leave when they are yet to finish the task and people welcome them?
No, I don't think the people welcome them. If you read newspapers and the vast majority of information that we get on social media, people of Beni Butembo, because people of Beni Butembo already remember that the Ugandans destroyed the fort of the Rwandans in the city of Kisangani in 1999, 2000 or 2001, and they fought again in Ituri in 2005. So people of Ituri, people of Beni, Mutwanga, all these areas, they resent Ugandans. They know them as predators, because you must know, and this needs to be in the line. So these folks, they're just coming to the Congo, and they're the guys under the cover of a joint military action to try and engage in, amplify, in fact, intensify, in fact, the illegal exploitation of Congolese minerals, and not only minerals, but agricultural products such as cocoa and coffee.
The Ugandan army just did not go into Congo on its own accord. The government, or for that matter, the president, gave them the go-ahead, although in a limited window or period, to go after these rebels in the DRC.
We must ask ourselves the question, does it make sense for President Tshisekedi to call on people who are known to have destroyed his country? That's question number one. But number two, what is it that the Ugandans have that South African Defense Force, which is there, doesn't have? That Kenya, which has got a more formidable army than the Ugandans, don't have? That Tanzanians, who have got more formidable soldiers and arsenals than the Ugandans, cannot do? So we must ask ourselves all these questions. The whole thing doesn't hold, my friend. It doesn't hold.
How pragmatic is your call for the Ugandans to redraw? Because it doesn't look like they are going to redraw anytime soon until the period given to them by the president and the government of Congo elapses.
Ugandan military, Ugandan establishment is known for its cynical exploitation of Congo. As we're talking now, Ugandans have got a gold refinery at Entebbe, and the investment was $15 million. That gold refinery at Entebbe, Sentry in America, International Crisis Group in America, Human Rights Watch, and various institutions, they have established that 80% of the gold refined in that refinery in Entebbe comes illegally from the DRC. More than 60% of Ugandan coffee is, in fact, Congolese coffee. The Security Council should stop playing games in the Congo. You can't have a MONUSCO that has got in its possession, as I'm saying right now, 3 combat helicopters equipped with missile launchers, equipped with grenade launchers, which could have helped the Congolese command to organize tactical engagement with air ground support. 3 Royal Force helicopters. I'm not talking one. I'm talking about 3. And South Africans also sent to the Congo 3 transport Oryx transport helicopters. Why isn't the MONUSCO? Why people should ask the MONUSCO? Actually, the Americans, the South Africans, they should ask the MONUSCO. What is this complacency all about? How can MONUSCO, with all the money, with all the troops, fail to do in 10 years what the Ugandans claim they've accomplished in 2 weeks?
Herbert Kabasu Babu Katolondi is also the author of the recently published book, U.S. Marines in the Congo-Benin War. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. Tanzania's main opposition party, Chadema, is calling on the country's Human Rights Commission to investigate why the prison service refused food from the family of its national chairman, Freeman Mbowe. The party also demanded the prison authorities to explain its decision, since Chadema argues other prisoners received food from their families respectively. This after members of the party and the family went to visit Mr. Mbowe during the country's recent independence celebration. The food the family brought to Mbowe was rejected by the prison authorities with no explanation. It prompted the opposition party to say this is yet another attempt by the authorities to infringe on Mbowe's rights. John Mrema is Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party. He tells me that it is unconstitutional and unacceptable for state institutions to be used to harass and intimidate opponents of the administration.
When it was the Tanganyika Independence Day, 60 years of Tanganyika independence, Freeman Mbowe was not allowed to receive food from his family. So we asked the prison service to come out and explain to the public why they did so, but until today they didn't do anything. And today, a new development is that the case has been adjourned until the 10th of January this year. So Freeman Boyle is be in bars for the next 21 days until the 10th of January. That's when we can see him in the court. We are not sure if for these 20 days they are going to allow us to visit him in the prison or not. But we're expecting they will allow us because it is his right. He has that right according to our laws. He's supposed to be visited by whoever wants to visit him and see him and discuss with him in the prison. So we are waiting to see if in these 21 days, when the cases have been adjourned, we are going to be allowed or not.
What has been the reaction of the Tanzanian Human Rights Commission after you launched a formal complaint asking it to investigate the circumstances?
What I can tell you for sure is that Tanzania Human Rights Commission, I don't know if they are existing or not, because we haven't seen a single statement from them for the last 2 years or 3 years now, since when the chairman of this commission was removed from the office during the President Magufuli's presidency. The new chair, we have never seen a single statement from him since when he was appointed way back 2018. No single statement has been issued in public. So we are not sure if this commission still exists or not. And as you know, the Human Rights Commission of the country is the ombudsman of the human rights of the people. But this ours is silent, various violations of human rights across the country, not only to the politicians. We've seen killings, but this Human Rights Commission is silent as if they are not existing. So even on our case, they have never issued a single statement on our request to them.
Some people are suggesting that he is being kept strictly by the prison service because of the charges of terrorism and other charges against him. That is why he's being held like that.
These charges of terrorism are fabricated charges, and everybody knows about it. And even until today, they are witnesses. Nobody has linked the Freeman Boy with terrorism in the court until today. So what we know for sure, this is a politically motivated case. It's a political case. And that's why we are urging the DPP, Director of Public Prosecution, to drop these charges, because they don't have any legal foundation to exist in the court. And we are sure one day they are going to drop it. And even the judges who are pursuing this case, they know for sure the prosecution side, they don't have single evidence, because we have seen the evidence on the committal. During the committal process, we have seen everything, what they have launched as their evidence of this case. What we know for sure is that they are going to drop it, if not today, tomorrow, or if not tomorrow, next year.
You seem to be very confident about that.
I'm very confident because we have seen what kind of evidence they do have. Because we know for sure Freeman Boy is not a terrorist, and he had never been like that until today.
John Bremer is Director of Communication, Foreign Affairs and Protocols for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. In Zambia, the Non-Governmental Gender Organizations Coordinating Council, or NGOCC, is criticizing the failure of political parties to adopt female candidates for the upcoming parliamentary by-election in the Kabuata constituency. The vote is scheduled for January 20, but all the political parties, including the ruling United Party for National Development, or UPND, and its alliance partners, as well as the main opposition Patriotic Front, presented male candidates for the poll. In a statement, Ngwase Mwali, the executive director for NGOCC, says the organization is disappointed that the political parties failed to adopt women candidates for the poll. She also expresses concern about the lack of commitment by the groups to enhance women's participation in politics and decision-making positions. Mrs. Mwali tells me that it is about time the government and all political parties demonstrate their commitment to gender equality.
As after the August general election, we saw a paltry 13% women in parliament and 7% women in the local government. And therefore, we had appealed to the political parties to utilize any other by-election to ensure that they even up, you know, the situation of the low numbers of women in parliament and the local councils. And therefore, because we made that appeal and we've been engaged with parties, it was our expectation that the political party leadership would actually show for once their commitment to the gender agenda by ensuring that to women to men. And therefore, it is our concern, and we are very disappointed as the focal point of the women's movement, that it seems the gender agenda is actually only a kind of lip service, you know, for our political party leadership. There is no genuine commitment to ensuring that what Zambia has signed for at a regional and international level, even at continental, in terms of the gender parity, is actually not being practiced. And we want to call upon parties to look at this matter seriously.
Well, since you raised your concern, what has been the reaction of the political parties? Because it appears that all the strong political parties participating in the upcoming by-elections fielded men instead of women, as you had anticipated.
Now, first and foremost, what we are seeing, obviously, is that the political party in government at the moment, the UPND, is appointing a number of women to various boards. We are not meeting the 50% mark. However, we strongly feel that the political space is that strategic level, because that means space for the nation. It is where decisions for the destiny of our country are being made. So yes, we also recognize the efforts that are being made within the public boards and the other commissions where, you know, certain appointments of women are being made. We still want to bring the political party's leadership, you know, to seeing that beyond just the public board, the aspect of our governance architecture is very, very important, and that is where we need to even up to ensure that we live by what is provided for in our constitution. Because Article 259 is very clear and categorical in terms of how Zambia should meet the 50-50 parity of ensuring that both women and men participate.
What do you tell people who are of the view that if the women themselves are not contesting in order to represent the party or in order to be adopted to represent the party, why blame the parties? Because the women should be able to come forward to be adopted. If they are not coming forward, you should not blame the political parties for wanting to win elections. How do you react to that?
Political parties are not creating an enabling environment within their parties themselves to be able to ensure that women's leadership emerges. Political parties are not providing capacity building platforms in order to be able to ensure that the women are prepared adequately for leadership positions. And this is why the back still stops at the political, because we strongly believe that creating that environment helps emerge. So whichever way we look at it, we know that that is just an excuse that women are not presenting themselves. The two largest political parties in this by-election for Kawata, we are very, very sure, and we saw the names that were finally shortlisted, you know, for the ultimate adoption of who was going to be on the ballot. We know that there were women from both the Patriotic Front and the UPND. There were women who were ultimately shortlisted in the top numbers that were presented today, you know, to the NEC.
So moving forward, will your organization engage all these political parties to help train or help equip to boost their capacity in order to represent the parties in the future in by-elections?
One of our member organizations whose mandate is to work with the women in political parties, the Zambia National Women's Lobby, has been undertaking a lot of capacity building, training in leadership, and also training the various women in the political parties on effective campaigning. So these interventions have been done by the women's movement, and we have been engaging the political parties. And most of the political parties, they do
performance or tell us in terms of, you know, that they are committed to ensuring that women participate. But when it's ultimate decision to ensure that the women find themselves on the ballot, we wonder what changes.
Ngwase Mwale is the executive director of Non-Governmental Gender Organizations Coordinating Council, or NGOCC. She spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Eswatini, the opposition Democratic Party says it will not accept any dialogue that would allow the government to determine the scope and outcome. The party reiterates its right to join other pro-democracy groups to demand talks mediated by a neutral international body backed by the United Nations. Pro-democracy groups say they worry that negotiations without preconditions will ultimately be determined by King Nswati III. They say any attempt to undermine talks mediated by a neutral body will worsen tensions in the Southern African Kingdom. They are also calling for the release of all political prisoners and a guarantee that those forced into exile will not be harmed when they return home to be part of the bilateral discourse. Imbogesini Shabangu is the General Secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He tells me that his party is ready to be part of a genuine dialogue by the country's neutral partners as part of the process to ease tensions in Eswatini.
Our main cause for concern is the government of Eswatini wanting to be in charge of the dialogue process. We are where we are because the Eswatini government has never talked to dissenting voices, has never opened a space to dissenting voices. So if they still want to control a dialogue process, unfortunately, most progressives and people calling for democracy are not eager for any process that will be underwritten, convened. I mean, the whole process being done by the oppressive regime. That's why we've been calling for regional organizations, SADC, United Nations, the European Union, the Commonwealth, the United States, the European Union, to help in the facilitation of this process. Because we would have not got into the June 2021 civil unrest if a Swatini government was talking to its people in a genuine, meaningful way that will be convened by a neutral international body or international organization.
But supporters of the government are of the view that you cannot be on the same level playing field as the king, who is an absolute monarch, and that your request is impractical. How do you address that?
What we are asking for, I mean, I would make an example of the apartheid South Africa. They did not go to the dialogue table with an apartheid constitution as a legal basis. So we can't go to a dialogue with the current constitution as is, because it totally gives all the powers, ruling, governing powers of Eswatini to the king, one person. So we will not go to a dialogue process with the current constitution as a legal basis. We need to come up with an interim constitution that will level the playing field, that will allow everyone to participate. We don't want to restrict anyone. The conservatives, traditionalists, the people who still believe in the status, and the progressives, and all the people that are calling for a democracy in Eswatini, we want a setup that will not hinder or restrict anyone.
So you mean that your party wants a new constitution to be a basis for the all-inclusive dialogue that you seek? How feasible is this?
We want an interim constitution. I mean, like I was making an example of South Africa. When they went for their dialogue, it wasn't a new constitution, it was an interim constitution. When they went for the first democratic elections in 1994, it wasn't a new election, it was an interim election. Until 1996, when all the the parties and all the people had gone to a democratic election. That is when they crafted their new constitution. It's as simple as that. It's a simple process that will be the same for us. Get into the dialogue on an interim constitution and maybe get into election using the interim constitution. Then, as a nation, come up with a new constitution.
At this moment, you are at a stalemate.
Yeah.
The demand for the dialogue, you said the government wants to hold all the powers for the dialogue. The opposition, including your party, says you want an all-inclusive dialogue on an evil playing field. Where do you go from here?
Yeah. It's simple. The pressure, what we've been doing since 1973, it's very simple for us. The call, the push for a democratic Eswatini. I mean, it's a game. It's not a new game to us. We don't want anything less than a basic democratic country where there's freedom to associate, to assembly, to determine your own government as people, not as a family, not one person determining the future and destination of the whole nation.
Imbogesini Shabangu is the General Secretary of the Swaziland Democratic Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Mbabane. Tidal waves and coastal erosion have submerged an entire fishing community on Ghana's eastern coast. Many villages already had been relocated because of past tidal waves, and they have petitioned the government for a permanent solution. For VOA, Senanu Todd reports from the village of Fuveme in Ghana.
The RC Primary School lays in ruins after what authorities say in November was the largest tidal wave to ever hit Ghana's eastern coast. It was the third relocation of the school further inland after two previous ones were completely submerged along with the Fuveme fishing community. Fuveme's assistant headman, Knowledge Diwonu, says no matter how many times the villagers move further away from the shore, flooding and coastal erosion have brought it right back.
So it started in 1997. And it did not destroy all the land. It destroyed part of it. And in 2016, it also destroyed part of it again. And in 2018, then it destroyed all the land at Fuveme. So you can't see anybody at Fuveme now. So these are the village near to the Fuveme, which is now being destroyed by the sea again.
The once thriving fishing village of 2,500 people has been reduced to a few hundred who are struggling to keep their heads above water. A United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO study, says 37% of Ghana's eastern coastal land was lost from erosion and flooding between 2005 and 2017. Emmanuel Gamega, chief executive of the coastal town of Keta, blames rising seas from climate change as well as human activities such as building dams and ports and harvesting sand from beaches to sell for use in construction.
So As the chairman of the MISEC, the Municipal Security Council, we held a meeting and we came out with an order which seeks to ban the fetching of the sand from the beaches until further notice.
In a meeting with authorities, Fuveme villagers said the ban was not enough. Seji Saji Amedonu, the deputy director of the National Disaster Management Organization, calls for building a sea defense wall as has been done on some other areas of the coast.
The whole shore of Ghana, from Axim to Aflawu, that protection needs to be done because if we protect one particular place and leave the others, the devastation will continue.
While all coastal West Africa suffers from erosion, Ghanaian experts say their country's long coastline, almost 550 kilometers, that's 350 miles, makes it most vulnerable. The University of Cape Coast Center for Coastal Management says Ghana's shoreline moves inland an average of 2 meters annually. Sena Anutod for VOA News, Fuveme Village, Ghana.
In some of the coups seen on the African continent, a common factor has been violent Islamist militants. The number of militant attacks increased this past year in the Sahel region, leading to political instability that saw a coup in Mali an attempted coup in Niger, and calls for Burkina Faso's president to resign. Burkina Faso experienced the deadliest terrorist attack since the conflict began, but analysts say the worst could be yet to come. For VOA, Henry Wilkins reports from the Burkinabe capital, Ouagadougou.
2021 marks the ninth year of conflict in Africa's Western Sahel, and in Mali, Burkina Faso and Niger, violence has only worsened. A video recently posted online purports to show an attack on a military base in northern Burkina Faso that killed almost 50 military police in November. Terrorists said to be linked to Al-Qaeda can be seen firing heavy weapons from the backs of pickup trucks before burning and looting the base. Across Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger, fatalities from clashes between state forces and armed groups linked to Islamic State, Al-Qaeda and criminal gangs are up 18% since last year, according to data from the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project. The humanitarian impact has been huge, with close to 3.4 million people now displaced as a result of the conflict, according to the United Nations Refugee Agency. Amadou Agli from Burkina Faso fled the north of the country about 3 months ago after terrorists attacked nearby villages. He says he has a message for the world. He says his community is living through very hard times and appeals to any people, NGOs and governments around the world who can help them. He says they're suffering, a food crisis, a housing crisis, and that the children are unable to attend school. The year also saw a shift in the region's military structure, says Paul Melly, an analyst with London-based Chatham House, a research institution.
Start the process of moving towards a new pattern of French deployment where the Sahel armies in the G5 Sahel military structure are much more the frontline face, if you like, with the French in a more of a backup and special forces role, air support, intelligence.
France, which had 5,000 troops supporting Sahel security forces at the beginning of 2021, has said it will reduce that number to 3,000 by early 2022. Escalating insecurity has also plunged Sahel government into political turmoil. Mali saw a coup by military leader Assimi Goïta in May after street protests against insecurity. The West African political bloc, ECOWAS, along with France, have put pressure on Goïta to hold democratic elections in 2022. Protests against the government's handling of security in Burkina Faso in November forced the government to reshuffle military leadership and the cabinet. Andrew Leibovich is an analyst with the European Council on Foreign Relations.
What people are concerned about is the ongoing insecurity and the state of the security forces. So if that doesn't improve, then no, the change in government certainly will not be enough to appease the opposition.
Leibovich says analysts are also keeping an eye on attacks in Burkina Faso's border area with coastal West Africa states, including Benin and Ivory Coast.
So I do think at a minimum it's something to really be concerned about, something to watch out for and something to actively work against.
Meanwhile, in Niger, the emergence of civilian militia groups to fill the security gap could play a big role in 2022. In other Sahel countries, they have been used to assist the military, but have also been accused of human rights abuses, says Philippe M. Fraud, an associate professor at the University of Ottawa.
We've seen this in southwestern Niger recently, kind of community violence, which is spiraling and driven a lot by non-state armed groups. We see this in Burkina Faso as well, where we have the state, in fact, relying on groups like this.
After a difficult 2021, the Sahel conflict looks set to worsen as the new year begins. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
Somalia's military chief is warning the armed forces against meddling in politics as the standoff between Somalia's president and prime minister raises concerns about violence between security forces loyal to each side. Analysts raise concerns about worsening instability. For VOA, Mohamed Kahiye reports from the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
Brigadier General Odawa Yusuf Ragi has warned the armed forces about the national security implications of the meddling in politics. He spoke to army commanders on national television Wednesday, a day after some forces loyal to Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble took up positions near the presidential palace.
Ciidanka xooga dalka Soomaaliyeed wax kuma qaba kariyo gurubo iyo koox gaar ah inay dabada ay la galaan.
He says Somali armed forces cannot operate within groups and be part of self-interest parties that have selfish motives. We need to be united and not lose our national sense of duty that we took an oath for. Similar sentiments were raised by the Commissioner of the Police Force, who called upon the agencies to focus on ensuring peaceful elections by maintaining law and order. Umar Abdulle is a political analyst and lecturer of international relations at Simat University. He believes words must be translated into action to avoid escalations like those in April, when opposing factions of troops clashed in the capital, Mogadishu. He says army chief's warning could prevent armed confrontations if his words are heeded. Samira Ahmed, the executive director of Mogadishu-based Hiral Institute, a security research group, says political rifts are already diverting security agencies from their offensive against the armed group Al-Shabaab. She says Al-Shabaab attacked Balad town, which is very close to Mogadishu, on Wednesday. The audacious attack came after the National Army vacated the front lines due to political differences. These rifts distract the focus from the fight against Al-Shabaab. The U.S. government has urged Somali leaders to put aside their differences and focus on conducting transparent elections planned in the near future. The Bureau of African Affairs urged President Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed, popularly known as Farmajo, and his Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble to end their political escalations while urging security agencies to remain neutral. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half, Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now, it's time for music from our African collection. It's one thing too much. It was supposed to be fun and innocent, but they give on you green, no grass. It was supposed to be sweet. This is ignorance, but you could not resist. One thing too much. Down and around this town, believing books say, not reading between the lines of my wings, Alex. Thinking this is real, hey, thinking this is real when you only escape. Well, escape is what you press when you're no longer satisfied. No longer satisfied. Oh, was I supposed to be fun and innocent, but they're giving you green. Supposed to be sweetness as ignorance, but you could not resist wanting to fall.
dance over indulgence. Abundance, abundance, over indulgence. Abundance, abundance, over indulgence. Abundance, abundance, over indulgence. Deeper never say again. Supposed to be fun and innocent. If I knew green or grass, was supposed to be sweet, this as ignorance. But you could not resist one thing so much. You was supposed to be fun and innocent. But if I knew green or grass, was supposed to be sweet, this as ignorance. Could not resist one thing so much.
Yeah. They call me burner.
I woke up with a fear this morning, but I can taste you on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah.
Alone without no warning, you're by my side and we've got smoke in our lungs.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor William Eagle and producer Tracy Carter, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, one who has been bitten by a snake lives in fear of the worms. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.